Access number 21128, Reel 2.
Bob Doe, Reel 2. What kind of role was 66 Squadron carrying out then?
Well, we were starting on fighter sweeps, but being based down in Cornwall, we were not involved in the main operations. But whilst we were there, we had the aircraft still being taken away and vandalised. Three squadrons this was happening to. What was happening is that Spitfires were being taken away and they were putting a fixed tank underneath one wing. And we found out later that the reason being that the Scharnhorst knives now, the German battleships, were in Brest. And they laid on a major raid, daylight raid, where they had over 100 bombers, which in 1941, it was fantastic. I can remember the composition of it, actually. We had the first three flying fortresses came over, 76 Hamden bombers, which were pretty useless, something like 30 Wellingtons, and three of the first Halifaxes. And it was a total of 130 bombers went over. And the reason we had these tanks stuck underneath one wing is that we were going to escort them. And it was very stupid, really, because having this tent fixed under one wing meant that we were flying a thing that no, it was a fighter. It just was quite incapable, actually, as a fighter. But we were lucky there. However, we went over with them and we escorted them. As we came into the area over Brest, where the sky became full of big back bursts and stuff, we went round it, we chickened out. We saw no point in flying through with them. So we went round it and met them on the other side. And they'd lost quite a few. And in fact, I escorted a damaged Hamden all the way back. I don't know whether he lost one engine or what, but I thought I'd give him peace of mind if I stayed with him. At least he'd know there's someone to say what's happened to him. And we came back. We had to go out again about 45 minutes later to escort Sunderland along the French coast, because apparently something like 33 aircraft had been shot down of ours. And try and pick up people. And that's the sort of operation we were doing with down there. Anyway, I was then sent to OTU.
Had you felt handicapped in the flying when you returned to 66 Squadron?
Handicapped in what way?
With your eyesight.
Oh, yeah. But I didn't tell anyone about it. Basically, no one knew about it. And I went to OTU, where I was in charge of the gunnery squadron, teaching people how to shoot. And I found it quite exciting. I trained Screwball Burling, who was the Canadian ace, Don Salvadori Gentile, who was one of the top American pilots who came over the Eagle Squadron.
Any memories of Burling?
Of what?
Any memories we can record of Burling?
Of what?
Burling.
Yeah, there are a lot. In fact, what you ought to do is read my book. I've really summarised it in that. And in fact, I was loaned to the Americans. The first American squadrons that came over the pond were two P-38 squadrons. And that's the Lightning. I think the two twin booms. And a man called Colin Gray and I were attached to these two squadrons to tell them how to fight the war, basically. They didn't listen, of course, they wouldn't, would they? But I did get to fly Lightning, which really wasn't a fighting airplane. It was a lovely airplane to fly. It's a tricycle undercarriage thing, and the only way you could tell if your nose wheel was down, you had no indicators in the cockpit. But they used to polish up a bit of the inner engine in the cell, where you could see if it was reflected, and that you could see if the nose was down or not. Also, they had one 20mm and two or 3.5s in the nose. They had one of the 0.5s which had a habit of breaking off from its mounting and suddenly wandering around the nose, still firing. Couldn't turn round, luckily. And the 20mm cannon had a blast tube on the side of the cockpit, so exactly opposite the propellers. So occasionally it would blow off, go straight in the propeller and knock the propeller off. So it wasn't really a fighting aeroplane, but it's fun to fly. And I realised that I wasn't really enjoying this too much, so I then left there and came back on operations again. And I had a short spell with 613 Squadron, which was flying Mustangs. Not the Mustang that fought the war so well, but the Mustang 1, which had the old Ellison engine. And it's incredible, because the engine was, if you wound it up, it took a long time, if you wound it up to high speed, you'd get nearly 400 miles an hour straight and level at sea level. It made it a very fast aeroplane. But as soon as you turned, the speed dropped back about 160 miles an hour. It has a high lift, no lift, high speed wing. And I didn't like that either. So it's not the sort of war I was enjoying. So I volunteered for Burma. I thought at least I'd get somewhere where I could start fighting the war the way I wanted to fight it. And I was eventually posted to Burma. And we sailed from Liverpool in October 1943. The day we sailed, the British government and the American government agreed that all troop ships would be dry. Now, I hadn't had a time to put a bottle in my bag or anything. No one had told us. So we sailed from Liverpool on a dry ship, which is not very nice, I assure you. And I was a senior RAF officer on board, and I had some 25 pilots that were being taken out to Burma. The first reinforcement of pilots to the Burma Theatre, because they were called the Forgotten Army, if you remember, out there. And this was the first reinforcements going out there to it. We sailed way out into the Atlantic, and we came back in with the first convoy to go through the Mediterranean after they reopened it. And we came through Gibraltar, where all the people there told the Germans exactly what was happening. And we then got attacked at night as we approached Sicily. And being attacked on a ship at night is a very scary business, I assure you. And we were all sitting, or standing around in a room, when some, well, one of the ship's crew came tearing and said, "Would you kindly move up to the lounge? You're sitting on top of the magazine." So we moved quickly. And after we got there, I started looking around the ship to see if there's any. I knew the ship would have to stop at Suez on the way through to get new equipment and stuff on board. And I realised that if I could find a good excuse, they might let me ashore. Well, I discovered there was no dentist on board, so I developed a violent toothache. They gave me a load of tablets, which went overboard very rapidly. And when we eventually came to Suez, my toothache had become diabolic. So I said I'd go ashore and go to the army doctor on shore. So I chased all the money I could from the air crew on board, 25 of us. And if I got memory serves me right, I collected about £90 cash, which was a lot of money in those days. And I went ashore, spent a very happy day ashore, buying booze. Cypriot ouzou, which is a Greek vicious stuff. South African brandy, which was very good. Cypriot wine, Cypriot sherry, which was very nice also. Then I got a huge crate, and I filled it full of these bottles. I bought some bananas and threw it over the top of the bottles. I had main troubles then finding people to carry this crate, but I did. We got done, because I knew that we were told, in fact, that the last boat back to the ship would leave at something like 6 o'clock or something like that. And I had to be back in time for that. And I missed it. So I saw this thing steaming off back to the ship. So I sat in the crate and lit a cigarette. wonder what the hell I was going to do. At which stage, there's a naval commodore who was taking passage on the ship. And he was coming down the jetty with a bunch of naval ratings carrying a case, which had ratings tropical gear on top of it. But when they put it down, it clinked. So I stood smartly to attention and said, "Sir, my case clinks as well. Could you give me a lift back to the ship?" And he was a rather decent chap, and he smiled and said, "Okay." And we got there, he said, "What's the number of your cabin?" So I told him. And he called the military police down and made them carry my case to my cabin. Apparently the law at that time was you could not drink alcohol on board, but once if you got to your cabin, there's nothing to bar you drinking it there. So it's perfectly safe once it's there. Anyway, about halfway between, we had a lovely time in them onwards. We sort of sailed to Golden Haze toward India. Halfway there, I developed this vicious toothache you ever known. And one of the surgeons pulled it out from him. Surgeons do not know how to pull teeth. And I was finished up with a dry socket, which is definitely as painful as a bad tooth. However, we sorted that out. And I was in India for a while, then I had a call from headquarters, would I like to form and command an Indian Air Force squadron? Can a duck swim? This was my dream. And I went up there to find that I had a squadron with of Hurricanes, which carried 2 500-pound bombs, which made them rather like flying a barge, but never mind, they were flying. I had about 7 English pilots, or British pilots, and 20-odd Indian pilots. I had about 500 Indian ground crew and about 60 British ground crew. And we were a very heavy squadron, actually. We got together very well indeed. And we trained in the Northwest Frontier. We went down to Lahore. And then we were told to go to an armed practice camp in the Marda Road in Bihar on our way down to Burma. Now, no Indian squadron has gone through this before. And I'd just come out from England, and where we started on this business of stream landings, the theory being kill everyone on the ground as quickly as you could so that you could refuel and get ready to get off again. And I trained this Indian squadron to do this thing. In fact, we landed at Amala Road. We were the first squadron ever to do this when we got there, where from the time I landed to the time the last aircraft landed, I hadn't turned off the runway when the last aircraft of my 16 lands on the runway. And they hadn't seen this done before. They thought this was miraculous. And this Indian squadron really went up in their estimation because Indians did not have a good repute out there. People tended to sneer at them. Anyway, we were then eventually sent down to Burma. We arrived in Burma just before Christmas 1943. And it was very enjoyable. We actually did 2 bombing raids on Christmas Day that year. And down there, the ration of drink was 1 bottle of beer per man per month. Not a lot. But I had 500 Indians who we accidentally returned as British, because Indians didn't get a drink ration. But I happened to return 500 Indians by accident, just written the wrong column. I mean, anyone could do it, couldn't they? And we had a very happy Christmas. And that Indians were brilliant, actually, because when the rains come, the monsoons came about that time of year, any bit of dusty road where it had a concave bit in it came full of water, and the next morning it was full of fish. I do mean full of fish. And they used to net these fish, and they're like white bait. They made wonderful curries. They also used to climb certain palm trees and cut the growing point out of the top, which is a wonderful cabbage. There's a fruit out there which looked like a red apple, which had a cashew nut hanging underneath it. The fruit was like a rough strawberry in taste, But we were warned, whatever we did, don't eat the nut, because that was bitter or something. So I'd never tried it, so I wouldn't know. And also there was a very famous place of priests of it, where they made a very famous palm toddy. So we went to visit them, and the palm toddy really is not worth trying. It's lethal. So we decided beer was best and went back home. Anyway, we carried on there. We did a couple of bombing raids every day. And we were then moved down to Ramrie Island as the army advanced, which was just north of Rangoon.
What had been the kind of targets which you'd had in the bombing?
We were mainly supporting the army. They'd call up and say they're being held up by a certain place, and we would bomb that place and knock out the guns there and that sort of thing, so the army could get through. We were bombing as close as 60 yards in front of our own troops, which in Burma was difficult because you couldn't see your own troops. You were working on a grid reference and map reading, which I had to do. On no occasion did we ever bomb our own troops, so I'm very proud of that. On one occasion we asked the 81st West African Division, had been cut off behind the jet lines, and we were asked if I would take the squadron in and land in there. What they planned to do was to knock a runway out of, you know the paddy fields. Well, in between they have what they call paddy buns. And it was the dry season when we went in, and they knocked a load of these paddy buns down and created a runway for us to land on. But they wouldn't have any equipment there, so we'd have to go and land and start on our internal accumulators in the aircraft, which one never did. But however, we said we'd have a go at this thing, and so we bombed up, and we charged up all our acts in the aircraft as high as we could. And we had to go in and land as quickly as we could, because we had to have enough fuel to do the operation and get back as well afterwards, without no question any fuel in there. And so we went into the Caladan Valley, where they were, and we did a famous stream landing, and I landed. And second I landed, the biggest cloud of smoke, dust you've ever seen came up off, because it was just a very dry season. And no question, I hadn't washed the run or anything, and it was just dust we were landing on. So the slipstream blew it up in the air, and I landed, and we managed to keep straight, and four of us taxed out the end. And then nothing else came out of this heap of dust. We thought, this is odd. And so we eventually walked back into the dust to find all the rest of the aircraft had gone straight down a hole in the runway. What happened, there's streams out there called chongs, and there was an underground chong which had gone underneath where this runway had been built that they didn't know about. And heavily laden aircraft, because we had two 500-pound bombs on board each of them, landing on the runway, eventually it broke the surface and they went straight down this hole into this chong. No one was hurt. But my pilots enjoyed operating as gunners in the army until afterwards. Anyway, we sort of, four of us there, and the army were wonderful. They gave us the safest thing, nearest thing to a Hilton they could devise, which was underground. They gave it a huge dugout, which they had overhead cover for, which was wonderful. And there we were. We had benches down, and they had sort of lots of silk parachutes which we could sleep on, and they really did make a fuss of us. And we got there, and that night the shelling started, and it really is I had never experienced shelling before, but when you knew they were trying to find you, you knew that because they'd seen us land, and you knew they were trying to get us in our aeroplanes. Our airplanes were sheltered in a corner, which was sheltered by a hill, so they couldn't actually get at them. But you had the feeling they knew exactly where you were, and the shells were landing sort of not too far away. And it's a terrifying experience. However, in the middle of the night, a senior surgeon from the division came in and said, come with me. So we followed him, and he took us to a local temple, which is the only place they could black out properly. And the only alcohol remaining in the division was some rum. And they fed us this rum, and it was wonderful. And I know we went back and went to sleep and said, the hell with the war. And next morning we woke up with a lovely black grinning black face with a big mug of sweet tea, which we then got up and went out and used the four aircraft we had to try and bomb them out for them, and they got out all right. And my chaps came out having to operate as gunners for the army. Whereas, shortly after that, we were moved down to Remri Islands, I say, which is an island off the coast, south of Akiab, just short of Rangoon. And it's the nicest situation I had the whole time I was in Burma, really, because there's a big, they made a runway of pierced steel planking, PSP, which was metal, holes in it, which they would sort of they joined together, and they just put it down. It was a runway. Hell of a noise when you landed on it. It was a very effective runway. And we lived on one side of the runway, and there's a swamp the other side, which bred every conceivable blood-sucking insect that ever happened. But horrible insects down there. There was one called hookworm, which if you got into you, it would eat its way straight through you, and when it came out the other side, you tied it round the matchstick so it couldn't go back in again. Anyway, these sort of things happened, and we operated from there, and about 2 weeks after we got there, we were suddenly told that there were no more bomb fuses available. There's a ship that had docked at Akiab, which had all the fuses for the bombs on board, and they stored it badly, so it's underneath 1,000 tons of coal or something like that, and we wouldn't be able to get the fuses until I reckon it'd take 2 weeks to empty this ship. So I tore up to group and got hold of the gun, the armaments officer, and he reckoned he had some airburst fuses. I said, well, all right, we'll use those. And the way these airburst fuses worked was that they had a nose cone which was rather a colander so the air could flow through it. And inside was a brass disc, concave disc, which has a long steel needle right in the centre of it. And as the thing fell, so the pressure built up between the nose and the ground. Eventually, stage came when the thing changed shape and the bomb exploded, which was a steel needle, went into the detonator. The only snag was you couldn't arm this thing safe. The ordinary bomb that we carried, it didn't become live until after it left the airplane some distance, because it pulled the pin out, so it was safe until it fell away. But these things couldn't be fused safe at all, so they're live from the moment they got on the airplane. Well, our gunners reckoned it shouldn't hurt us if we had dive bombing, but we decided we didn't like the idea of dive bombing with these things on board at all. So we decided we'd go pattern bombing, where we follow up the broad formation, and as we approached the target, I'd sort of keep doing this, and eventually say, steady, steady, bomb, and we'd all release them. I worked out the 24 500-pound bombs landing in a neat pattern at the same time should do quite a bit of damage. And they did too. I saw the result on one occasion, is when we bombed the Japanese 75th Division headquarters at Sakinmore. We went down to sort of see if we could start anything going on there. And the Sakinmore was a small town, big town for that part of Burma, I suppose, really. And the town was utterly flat. And two launches were in flames on the river. So we saw how it worked. It worked very well. But eventually, then were pulled out, brought back to India to re-equip with Spitfires for the invasion of Malaya. And we'd been living on meat and veg and bully beef all the time we'd been down there. And we were really looking forward to a decent meal. In fact, food down there, we lived out of tins, really, but our food was better, I think, than the English squadron, because we had an Indian squadron, and our curries were really quite wonderful. We had wonderful curries down there. The only thing we didn't fancy was curry for breakfast. So the 20-odd British people at that time used to take in turns, me included, as I was CEO, didn't make the odds, took in turns to cook breakfast, and we used to get tins of bacon. We came through in the rations every now and again, which are encased in white fat. But you tip this tin of bacon into a frying pan over an open fire, and we took a couple of chapatis from the Indians, and it's a very good breakfast, most enjoyable. Anyway, we decided the one thing we really fancied more than anything else was a decent meal when we came out. Well, I brought the squadron out, and we landed at Bagachi, which was the airfield at Calcutta. And I saw the station master and said, could I borrow three tunnels to get the chaps into Calcutta, because we hadn't had a decent meal for years, we'd love one. And he understood, and he sent us a lorry with a driver to take us in and bring us back. We went to the best best restaurant we knew in Calcutta, which was Furpo's. And I can, to this day, I can remember what we ordered. We started off with prawn cocktail, then had steak, shoty potatoes with salad, and we were looking at all the sweets when we got to it. Not one of us got more than a quarter of the way through the steaks. We were all violently ill. Our stomachs just had not got the ability to cope with a decent meal. It took us about a week before our stomachs got back to normal. But it's quite a lesson, that. Anyway, we then went down to finish up in Yellowhanker, which was one of these beautiful inland cities that they have in India, with officers' clubs, which were long stretches of open lawn, beautiful beds, and oh, it was beautiful. But they, one thing they didn't like was dirty uniforms. And Indian officers, all of which I had. So we made up our own club in a Chinese restaurant where we lived very happily. I had a lot of trouble with the military police because they were picking my chaps up and being scruffy, which they couldn't help because the only uniforms they had were what they'd lived in Burma for a couple of years. And I went and saw the chief military policeman, and I told him exactly what happened, what I thought of him and his troops. And things did improve a bit, but I shouldn't have had to do that.
What was the number of this Indian squadron?
10 Indian. I beg their pardon, 10 Royal Indian Air Force. Cool. And then I was sent for the squadron, and I went to, sent to the Indian Staff College at Quetta. Two RAF officers and two naval officers were sent on each course, just to maintain this sort of inter-service relationship, I suppose. And that was a very happy few months. And while I was there, the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. And I did admire the commandant of the staff college, who was a major general. And the morning after the bomb had gone off, he gave a lecture on how it had been made. And I thought that was brilliant. And I received my DSO while I was there as well. And I was captain of cricket while I was there. I've always been keen on cricket. And we had a wonderful cricket team. And it was, the cricket ground at Quetta was inside the race course, which used to run round the cricket ground. So we could see all the things that were happening in the race course. And there were some dirty tricks going on there, which we could see, be on the inside of the track, away from the stands. And as a result, I never bet on horses.
What kind of dirty tricks were these?
or was it people hitting each other and trying to get them out of the saddle and this sort of thing. You could see someone lifting them on the leg trying to get them out. Anyway, I left there and came down to Delhi, where I was made air plans. This is the end of, this is the beginning of what year? I've lost all track. End of December 1945. And I was made air plans at their headquarters in India.